This chapter actually contains four sections, and in the first four verses we have the first of these sections, and each of these sections can be associated with a particular person. These first four verses are associated with Keturah. Now Abraham took another wife, whose name was Keturah. Actually, we learn that Keturah was not the second wife that Abraham married after Sarah died, as much as she was a concubine or a secondary wife. That is referred to in verse 6 of this chapter. And it's also, Keturah is also called a concubine in 1 Chronicles. So we know that Abraham was married to Sarah and he had some secondary wives, which was customary in that culture, though not entirely pleasing to God. We don't know when he was married to Keturah. It could have been while Sarah was alive. It probably was. It could have been after he died. There's no way of telling from the way this verse is written. The word now with which the verse begins can be taken as simply a circumstantial occurrence, not necessarily sequentially following what precedes, that is, the death of Sarah. And Keturah bore to him Zimran, and Jokshan, and Medan, and Midian, and Ishbak, and Shua. And Jokshan became the father of Sheba and Dedan, and the sons of Dedan were Asherim, and Letushim, and Leumim. All tongue twisters. The most outstanding of these sons is, of course, Midian in verse 2. And one of the reasons for this list of the sons of Abraham through his concubine Keturah was that the Midianites descended through Abraham. Later on in their history, the Midianites became very strong enemies of the Israelites. And we can see that they had their origin in Abraham. They were relatives of the Israelites, but as time went by, they became hostile to them. I think the point of this brief section of verses is that God was faithful in giving Abraham many descendants, as he had promised him. And we have read many of those promises in the previous chapters. God said that he would make him fruitful, multiply him, make his descendants great in the earth. And that's what we find here. Some question has arisen concerning Abraham's ability to bear children late in life, and we don't know really whether God gave Abraham the ability to have other children after Isaac was born. That seems to be the case. Supernatural ability, since he was over 100 years old when Isaac was born, or whether these sons were born previously and were more natural sons of Abraham. In either case, God fulfilled his promises to Abraham and Sarah and gave them many descendants. The second section in this chapter runs from verses 5 through 11. And here Abraham is the central character. Now Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac. In chapter 21, verse 12, we read, "But God said to Abraham, 'Do not be distressed because of the lad and your maid, that is Ishmael and Hagar. Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her, for through Isaac your descendants shall be named.'" This was a command from God. And now we find that Abraham is obeying that command. He's giving all that he had to Isaac, that is, he became his heir. "But to the sons of his concubines," to the sons of Hagar and Keturah and possibly other unnamed women that he may have had as concubines, Abraham gave gifts while he was still living and sent them away from his son Isaac eastward to the land of the east. And these descendants of Abraham lived in Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, which is to the east of the Promised Land. And these are all the years of Abraham's life that he lived, 175 years. When Abraham died, Isaac was 75 years old, and Jacob was 15 years old. And Abraham breathed his last and died in a ripe old age. Remember back in chapter 15, verse 15, God had promised Abraham, "As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age." And 175 is definitely a good old age by any standard. Though, of course, in those days, people lived longer than they do today. He was gathered to his people. He was an old man satisfied with life. The phrase "gathered to his people" indicates that he was reunited with friends in the place of departed spirits, called Sheol in Scripture in the Old Testament. And this reference presupposes life after death, which, of course, the New Testament teaches more explicitly. He was gathered to his people. That is, he just didn't cease to exist, but he continued to exist with others who had preceded him, with whom he was reunited after death. Hebrews 11, chapter 5. Oh, I'm really getting my tongue twisted around this morning. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 13 tells us that the patriarchs died in faith, looking for the fulfillment of promises that were not completely fulfilled when they died. And part of that fulfillment comes because a person does not cease to exist when he dies. But as we read in this verse, he is reunited with others who have preceded him. This doctrine of life after death is further developed later in Scripture. Then his sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar the Hittite, facing Mamre. And we read about Abraham's purchase of that cave for the burial of his wife. The field which Abraham purchased from the sons of Heth, there Abraham was buried with Sarah his wife. And it came about after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac. And Isaac lived by Beer Lahai-Roi. God blessed his son Isaac, another indication of God's faithfulness to his promises, to bless Abraham and his descendants. Beer Lahai-Roi, you'll remember, was south of Hebron, down in the Negev, in the direction of Egypt, in a pretty barren wasteland area. The third section goes from verses 12 through 18, and it is highlighted by Ishmael. He is the central figure in this section of verses. Now these are the records of the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's maid, bore to Abraham. It's the customary format of Moses in writing the book of Genesis to let minor characters in the narrative kind of take a curtain call before the major actors continue to play out their role in the story. And that's what he's doing here. This is kind of the end of the references to Ishmael that we'll have for a while. And he concludes with a record of Ishmael's descendants. These are the names of the sons of Ishmael, by their names in the order of their birth. And he gives those in these verses, and dropping down to verse 16, "These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their villages and by their camps." Many of these names of individuals became the names of towns or settlements, as we saw, for instance, of Haran earlier. That was the name of a man. It became the name of a town because his descendants continued to populate that area. 12 princes according to their tribes. Chapter 21, verse 18 says, "Arise, lift up the lad, and hold him by the hand, for I will make a great nation of him." That is Ishmael. This was God's promise to Abraham that he would make a great nation of Ishmael. And we find that that's what's happened. He already has many descendants. He had 12 sons, like Jacob had, and like others in the Old Testament. Very interesting that he had so many. In chapter 17 and verse 20, he was promised 12 princes would come out of his loins, and we see that that promise is fulfilled here. Chapter 17, verse 20 says, "He shall become the father of 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation." So you see what Moses is highlighting in all the verses that we've looked at so far is God's faithfulness to his promises to do such and such for Abraham, for Ishmael, for Abraham's descendants. And these are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years. And he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. And they settled from Havilah to Shur, which is east of Egypt, as one goes toward Assyria. He settled in defiance of all his relatives. In chapter 16, verse 12, this was predicted of Ishmael, that his hand would be against his brothers and his brothers' hands would be against him, you remember. So in this little postscript, at the end of his life, Moses records God's faithfulness to that prediction that this would happen to Ishmael. So all through these first 18 verses, the emphasis is on the faithfulness of God to his promises. Verse 19 begins the last section, and this one deals with Isaac and with his two sons who are born. Now these are the records of the generations of Isaac. Verse 12, we read the generations of Ishmael, now the generations of Isaac. One of the ways to divide the book of Genesis up into sections is by noticing these references, like, these are the records of the generation of so-and-so. There are many of these throughout the book, and they act as major divisions in the book. At this point, Isaac becomes the chief character in the book of Genesis. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian, or the Aramean, later called Syrians, of Padan Aram, that is the flatland of Aram, up near Haran, that we read about last time, the sister of Laban the Syrian, to be his wife. And Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. Interesting. Sarah was barren. Now Rebekah is barren. And what was Isaac's reaction to this? He prayed. He prayed to the Lord on the behalf of his wife. It's interesting that this is the first reference to a patriarch praying per se. Of course, Abraham talked with God before, but now it is recorded that Isaac prayed to the Lord. And he prayed about his wife's condition, because that was crucial, of course, in view of the promises of God. If God was going to fulfill his promises to Abraham and to Isaac and to their descendants, Isaac's wife would have to bear children. And the Lord answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. We learn by comparing verses 20 and 26 that she was barren for 20 years. So Isaac prayed a long time. Why? Why would God make this woman barren and then give her children? I think probably for the same reason that he made Sarah barren and gave her children, so that her children would be recognized as the heirs of God's grace, the children of grace, rather than simply the children of nature. And so that in the birth of these sons, God's hand would be crystal clear. His dealings with these patriarchs would be very evident. But the children struggled together within her. And she said, "If it is so, why then am I this way?" That's a very awkward translation. We could better render it this way. Why me, God? Why is this happening to me? So she went to inquire of the Lord. Very interesting. This is a godly woman. Something's happening to her. She doesn't understand it. And so she prays about it, just like her husband. Very interesting. Little notations about these people that give us great insight into their character. Why me, God? Why is this happening to me? Something's going on in my body that I don't understand. And as we read on, we read that she was having twins. And that's what was going on. And these twins were at war with one another in her womb. And I guess most of you ladies that have carried children have wondered what's going on from time to time. And if there are twins and if they are having battles already before they are born, it's obvious and easy to understand why she would feel this way. Why me, God? Why is this happening to me, since I am to be the mother of the heirs of promise? Am I going to miscarry these children? What's happening within me? And the Lord said to her, the Lord intervened and gave her an answer to her prayer. And he said, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples shall be separated from your body. The one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. This was an oracle pregnant with significance, if you don't mind the pun. But God revealed to Isaac and to Rebekah that she would bear twins, and the older shall serve the younger. Now, later on in Scripture, we read about God's choice of Jacob over Esau. He chose to bless Jacob in a way that he did not choose to bless Esau. And this has been a problem for many people. And they have concluded that God chose Jacob in the sense that he foresaw what Jacob was going to do. And therefore, he gave this prophecy that he would bless him. But that is not what it means. God's choice to bless Jacob in a special way was without regard to thinking ahead to what Jacob's response would be. We're going to see that Jacob was a pretty devious person. His character is one of the most difficult to understand in Scripture. It's a very convoluted type of personality, and it's important that we understand him correctly. But the point here is that God predicted that Jacob would be the one through whom the blessing would come, even as he predicted that Isaac would be the one rather than Ishmael, or that Abraham would be the one rather than Abraham's brothers. You see, God announced this ahead of time. And as we see it worked out, we see that the promise of God is true. When her days to be fulfilled, to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red all over, like a hairy garment. One of the commentators, a man named Gunkel, has said that he looked like a little goat. And that's pretty strong judgment, I would say, of Jacob. But that is the inference of the description here, that he was not just hairy on his head, but he had hair all over his body. He was an unusually hairy child. First child in the Bible named Harry. And they named him Esau, which means hairy one. And afterward, his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob. Now, Jacob means one who takes by the heel in the sense of overthrowing. Now, in order to understand this, we have to understand something about ancient sports. Because in ancient times, wrestling was one of the favorite sports, was one of the few sports. And as two men would wrestle, if the person wrestling with the other person would get his opponent by the foot, He could twist his foot and turn him over and make him fall down, and then he would be the winner. And that's what it's talking about here when it says that he was one who grasped his brother by the heel. He would be one who would in the future overthrow his brother. And so they gave him this name Jacob, which means the one who holds the heel, or the one who supplants, the one who overturns. He, being the younger, would become the more powerful of the two. And Isaac was 60 years old when he gave birth to them. We might say that Jacob followed hard on the heels of Esau. When the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field. But Jacob was a peaceful man. Peaceful here has some connotations that it would be helpful for us to identify. It means that he was an amiable person. He was a pious, cultured type of individual. Whereas, by contrast, Esau was a rugged outdoorsman. We would call Jacob a, quote, cool character today. He was that kind of a person. He was a cool individual. He was a thoughtful, calculating person, cultured, amiable. The Greek word is tom. And you can think of all those good qualities in connection with that word. You see. He lived in tents. That is, he preferred the indoors to the outdoors. Now, Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game. That is, Isaac did. But Rebekah loved Jacob. Boy, this is really true to life. You see, Isaac and Rebekah were very different in their personalities. Isaac was a very passive person. We can see this in the record of his experiences in Genesis. Rebekah, on the other hand, was more aggressive. Very interesting that Isaac loved the more aggressive of his sons. And Rebekah loved the more passive of the sons. They were attracted to the opposites, as is so often the case. The active parent was attracted to the passive child. The passive parent was attracted to the active child. And when Jacob had cooked stew, literally a lentil, a bean-type dish, Esau came in from the field, and he was famished. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I am famished." A more literal translation would be, "Let me gulp down some of that red." Therefore, his name was called Edom, or Red. This became a nickname for him. And Esau, hairy, became Red. Of course, he had red hair, but this reinforced that. And he became the father of the nation called Edom, the Edomites. That kind of makes you wonder whether these were the first redskins. But in any case, Edom means red. But Jacob said, "First sell me your birthright. Before I'm going to give you some of this stew, you've got to sell me your birthright." Now, the birthright in the ancient Near East was a special possession that we don't have today in our culture. The firstborn in the ancient Near East, by custom, received the birthright. And the birthright entitled him to become the head of the family. He became the priest of the family. Later on, he received a double portion of his father's inheritance as the possessor of the birthright. It also entitled him, in this case, the possessor of the birthright, to the promises of God. The owner of the birthright would be the one through whom God fulfilled his promises to Abraham and Isaac. And that's why Jacob wanted it. So Jacob uses this situation, and he makes Esau an offer. And I suppose when Jacob made it, he wasn't at all sure whether Esau would be interested in this or not. But Esau said, "Behold, I am about to die. So of what use then is the birthright to me? very interesting insight into this man's character. He didn't value that one bit. He was willing to settle for a gulp of stew and give up his birthright to obtain it. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 16 calls Esau a profane man. Not that he used bad language, but that he was only interested in the satisfaction of his physical needs. He had no interest in spiritual values. He was willing to sell his birthright for a gulp of stew. And Jacob said, "First swear to me." In other words, before we make this transaction, I want you to give your word. So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Now we have references from other writings in the ancient Near East that birthrights were sometimes given back to the original recipient by the father. And perhaps Esau thought that might be done by Isaac. And maybe he parted with it quickly for that reason. But in any case, it's obvious here that he didn't regard it very highly. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. That's the punchline to the whole story. That's Moses' judgment of the significance of this event. Esau despised his birthright and the promises of God that it was the key to obtaining. He cared only for the momentary satisfaction of his physical desires. Let's point out some applications for this chapter before we open it up for some questions and comments. In the first three sections that we've looked at this morning, through verses 18, I think the emphasis that is made is intended to remind us that what God has promised will come to pass. Again and again in those sections, we have connections with earlier promises, and Moses shows how these promises were fulfilled. What God has promised will come to pass. This is a lesson in almost every chapter in the book of Genesis, because one of the primary purposes of this book, and God giving it to us, is for us to develop a deep-seated confidence in God's faithfulness to His Word. And we have testimony after testimony again in this chapter to the fact that God will remain true to His Word even though it requires supernatural activity to do so. A second application is that when God's will is not coming to pass, we should pray about it. In verses 21 and 22, Isaac and Rebekah both prayed to God, evidently for 20 years. And what did they pray about? They prayed for the fulfillment of God's promise. They asked for a child because to have a child was within the will of God, as He had promised. And when God has given you and me an assurance from His Word, we have every right to bring that to Him in prayer and to persist in it until He delivers the goods. Jesus teaches us how important it is to be persistent in our praying, and we see here that they persisted for 20 years. Now, this isn't just saying, "Lord, give me a new car." This is praying within the will of God. What they were asking for was definitely God's will for them. And whatever is the will of God for you and me, we can bring to God in prayer and persist, knowing that God will bring it to pass. That's a tremendous encouragement to us in our praying, isn't it? A third application comes out of the last part of the chapter, and that is that people who value spiritual things prosper. Jacob was the one through whom God blessed the Israelites, not Esau. Now, this is a very ironic thing in life. Esau was a man who was concerned with the here and now, with the physical, with the material. And undoubtedly he felt that it was important to give attention to these things if he was going to succeed and prosper in the world. Jacob, on the other hand, regarded the promises of God as most important. And he obtained what Esau did not. Now, we could divide mankind in the same basis today. Most people are concerned with the physical, material needs of life and give all of their time and thinking and energy to these things. Others regard the promises of God as more important and give themselves to spiritual things. And who are the ones that succeed eventually? It is those who recognize spiritual priorities. Today, just as in the patriarch's day. Now that makes me examine my life, and I think it should make you examine your life too. What am I giving my time and attention and thinking to? What am I all wrapped up in life? Is it the material things? Is it getting ahead? Is it providing security for the future? Is it getting a big enough savings account so that the future will not be a threat? Now, those things are important, but they are not the most important thing. The most important thing is to concentrate on the spiritual realities of life, the promises of God, the things that He has said He will do for us and wants to do through us. And to making ourselves instruments whereby He can execute His work in the world. Making ourselves available to Him to do what He wants us to do. Now, I'm not talking about everybody dropping out of his job and going into, quote, Christian work. I'm simply suggesting that we prioritize our lives in terms of spiritual values. What is really more important in life? A person like Jacob, who puts spiritual values first, will come out far ahead in every case. It's one of the great lessons we learn as we compare Jacob and Esau.